Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We're your hosts, Vincent Hannum
and Matt Levine,
and we're talking about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. Hey, Matt. Welcome. How are you?
I'm good. That was seamless. I loved it. I'm good. Happy to be back on the pod. How are you?
Good. Happy to talk about yet another King Kong so soon after our last one. Just felt like we had to make up for lost Kong representation on this podcast.
That's like our number one sort of like, you know, visibility and representation concern is King Kong, as it should be. So I'm just kidding. That's a bad joke. We talked about like the three straight up versions of King Kong, or we talked about two of them and now the 1976 version.
Is there a reason it was the last one we got to?
I feel like it's, you know, often forgotten by fans of King Kong. Like the original is a classic, of course. The Peter Jackson remake from 2005 is, of course, more recent, and like it's long, it's epic, it looks great, it has great special effects. So I feel like the 1976 version is like caught in the middle a little bit, you know?
Totally agree. And like, it's such a product of its time. We'll get into that. That's a bad thing. I love films from the 1970s. I feel like there's a grit to it. There's an aesthetic, a sort of a sweeping nature to it, or a melodrama to it. But for better or for worse, that could also date the film a bit more than other aesthetics.
Yeah, for sure. You kind of get the sense that this version of King Kong is kind of like pulled in a lot of different directions. Like, should it kind of be like a purist homage to the original, or should it like, you know, be like kind of like a radical re-envisioning? I feel like it never knows exactly what it wants to do.
Well, before we get into that, I just want to thank you all for listening to Camp Kaiju week in, week out, week in, week out. And thanks for our patrons for your support. Can't thank you enough. Jason, Kelly, Peggy, and our anonymous donor. Thank you. You, everybody out there listening, please rate and review Camp Kaiju wherever you listen. You can also share this podcast with a friend. Who doesn't love monster movies? You can also send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com, on Instagram at camp_kaiju, or our YouTube page, which is Mischief Tales. I'll put the links to that in the bio as well. You can also check out our website, campkaijumoviereviews.com. Spooky season is next week. So we have some really fun, really campy movies lined up. Matt, do you want to go into that a little bit? What we can expect in October on Camp Kaiju?
Absolutely, yeah. So first off, but in no particular order, I'll just say, Plan 9 from Outer Space, the Ed Wood masterpiece, one of a kind. I can't wait to talk about that one. Shortly after that, we have a similarly kind of so bad it's good classic, Troll 2, which has to be seen to be believed. Can't wait to talk about that one.
Yeah.
And then the last one for October that we're going to talk about is The Toxic Avenger, to finish our spooky season, guilty pleasure extravaganza.
And Day of the Triffids.
Oh, how could I forget? Day of the Triffids. Yeah. Yeah. Which I've wanted to see for a long time. Killer plants. You can't go wrong.
Mm-hmm. The oft-overlooked killer plant genre. Day of the Triffids. Little Shop of Horrors. And one that has been requested more than once from listeners, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes from the late 70s. It looks It looks delicious. I can't wait to see it one day.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, I would love to see that. There's also The Happening by M. Night Shyamalan, which, you know, I think actually you can certainly go wrong when you make a movie about killer plants. I think that's often how it goes. And that's a good case in point. But, you know, maybe that's one of the charming things about the subgenre.
Yeah, let's explore that subgenre, shall we?
Yeah. There must be like a particular term for it, although I can't think of it right now. Plantsploitation, maybe?
Well, that's what we're calling it from now on.
We have to.
Throwing this out there to all of our listeners to put on your radar is the Twin Cities Horror Festival. It is a theater festival running from October 19th through the 29th, featuring a play that I wrote about a killer hand, handsploitation, if you will. It is called The Hand That Washed Ashore. And on Friday, October 20th, is our opening night. We'd love to see you there. We'll call it a opening night Camp Kaiju bash. Like, just come out, represent, say hi. We'd love to see you and enjoy some monster theater.
I can't wait to see it. I've seen one play that you were in, although I don't think you wrote it, but I read another one of your scripts that you wrote. Mm. And yeah, I'm a big fan of your work, so I can't wait to see this play.
Thanks, man. And yeah. Gotta shout out your own work. Matt has a novel. It's called Hollow. It's been out for a while, but it is perfect for spooky season. It's about witches and ghosts and
demons. Yeah, yeah. Wisconsin/Midwestern horror is my vibe. Yeah, I love it.
I love that too.
Thank you for shouting out the book. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's good. It's really dark, but I love it.
Yeah, some other people have mentioned that to me. Like, yeah, I mean, like, I didn't, like, people that know me in person, it's like, I didn't think it was going to be so dark, which I kind of take as a compliment, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wait until you see my killer hand play. You'll never think of me the same way again.
Awesome. Man, I'm so excited.
All right. King Kong 1976. Matt, what's your personal history with this film?
I actually saw it for the first time relatively recently, a couple months ago, maybe like late July, I think. You know, I had never seen it before then. I was always curious about it. Of course, I love the original King Kong. And then I watched most of it again before recording this episode. Yeah, it's a weird movie. And I think, you know, fans of the original King Kong or just monster movies in general, if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's worth, you know, it's just so unique. It's kind of a product of its time, as we briefly alluded to. So yeah, it's a weird little oddity for sure.
Yeah. My personal history of this film is similar to yours. I didn't see it until a couple of years ago when I got into, watching kaiju movies I hadn't seen before, seeing the remakes of classics or sequels. You know, there's a sequel to this movie, this version of King Kong?
Yeah, I did know that, from like the early 80s, right?
Yeah, same director, and I have it on DVD. I got it from Video Universe. Rest in peace.
Yeah.
I can't wait to watch this because I know it is critically pretty ill-regarded.
Those can be my favorite movies sometimes.
I know, yeah. So as long as it's not boring, right? As long as a movie, it can be terrible, but still, just don't be boring. Then I'm on board.
Boredom is the cardinal sin of movies. I totally agree.
Yeah.
Does King Kong Lives have any of the same cast as this movie? Jessica Lange or Jeff Bridges or anybody?
No. Not that I know of, not the stars. Linda Hamilton is in it.
Oh, cool.
And Brian Kerwin.
Hmm.
I don't know him. I don't know any of the other names, but Linda Hamilton.
Well, I'm definitely intrigued.
Yeah. All right. Movie night. So the plot synopsis of this King Kong, we're not going to go into it because it is the King Kong traditional story. Now, there are some notable differences. The film is set in the mid-1970s. And rather than, you know, you have Carl Denham in the 33 version. He's a maverick filmmaker. in this 76 version, you have a man who's leading an expedition to find oil reserves for an oil conglomerate called Petrox. So he serves as the Denim character. I think those are the main differences, you think?
Yeah, I think so. I would say maybe, you know, there aren't any dinosaurs on the island in this movie. And I think like more story time is devoted to the relationship between Kong and Dwan, as the character is named in this movie. It's kind of like the version of the Andaro character from the original film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have the World Trade Center instead of the Empire State Building at the end. But yeah, aside from that, it's pretty much, you know, the same story.
Yeah. Speaking of the cast, playing Dwan is Jessica Lange. This was her first film. She was an unknown at the time. Playing opposite her is Jeff Bridges as Jack Prescott, who is substituting for the Jack Driscoll character in this case. Jeff Bridges, at this time, young leading man, Hollywood star. He had been in movies like in the early 70s, like The Last Picture Show. What other movies was he in the 70s?
Oh, he was in Fat City, which is a John Huston movie, a boxing film that's supposed to be good. I've never seen that. Thunderbolt and Lightfoot. Clint Eastwood was in that movie as well. That's another one that's supposed to be very good, although I haven't seen it yet. But yeah, I mean, I think this was relatively early in his career. You know, I think he started in the early 50s as a kid, and he was in like TV shows and like little bit roles up until the 70s, but his career didn't really take off until then, I think.
Right, right. He had a bit part in High Noon as a kid.
I did not know that.
Because his dad, Lloyd Bridges, is in that movie.
Oh, of course, yeah.
He's like some stable kid who like says something cheeky to Lloyd Bridges or something.
Cool. I had no idea he was in that.
Yeah.
I did read that he was in an episode of Lassie, so that's, you know, a claim to fame, I suppose.
Yeah. So, yeah, definitely a name at this time. A couple other shout-outs I just wanted to mention, that playing the captain, the head of the oil, the representative of the oil company, the character's name is Fred Wilson, played by Charles Grodin. And then Captain Ross is played by John Randolph.
Charles Grodin is, well, maybe I should save this for later. He's maybe my favorite part of this movie. I'll just say that for now. He chews the scenery, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So the film was directed by John Guillermin. He had done The Towering Inferno, I think, shortly before this movie. French-British director. Don't really know a lot about him. I think he was kind of like a temperamental figure on set. He got into a lot of arguments and shouting matches and stuff like that. Usually that kind of behavior is reserved for like great artists. I don't know if you can call him a great artist, but maybe that's debatable.
I don't know, man. The Towering Inferno, that Academy Award winning film, I don't know if it holds up, but you know, it's a memorable movie.
Yeah, it is for sure. I think that's one of many movies that the Oscars got wrong, but you know, that's my opinion. not to be, you know, I feel like I'm really hating on John Guillermin right now. I don't feel strongly about him, I guess, but
ooh, John Guillermin.
Yeah, I'm the president of the anti-John Guillermin anti-fan club. The screenplay was written by Lorenzo Semple Jr., who I don't really know very well. I'm looking, The Parallax View, 3 Days of the Condor, two very good, like, paranoid political thrillers from the 70s.
Mm.
So yeah, he's a good writer. He wrote some episodes of Batman, the original TV series. So yeah, some good credits on his resume.
Nice. The film is produced by the one and only Dino De Laurentiis, the famed Italian producer. We talked about him with Orca, the Killer Whale. He'd been producing films in Italy for a number of decades, right? For a while.
Yeah, I think he started in the 50s, and he worked with some really great directors like Fellini, some other good ones too. Nobody's really come to mind right now, but yeah, he had a long career. Yeah.
Then he comes to Hollywood in 1975. King Kong is his I think it's his first American picture.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course he goes for the biggest American movie title he can think of. And he directs, he produces this film. He produces the sequel King Kong Lives. He also produced Piranha 2 The Spawning. So for as much, for as many great titles as there are on his resume, there are some questionable titles as well. But I think that's part of his charm.
Mm-hmm.
I love this dude. I'm part of the Dino De Laurentiis fan club.
Yeah, like I feel like you can tell that he just loves movies. And like any project is like, yes, this is going to be the greatest movie ever made. And yeah, like you said, that leads to a lot of bad movies, but also some really great ones. And it's hard not to like somebody like that.
Yeah, for sure.
The music by John Barry, who scored a lot of James Bond films. I think you can tell from listening to the soundtrack of this movie, there was some like brass and horns. And I was like, whoa, am I watching a Bond movie all of a sudden? A very distinct sound, but I love it.
Yeah, it's a treat to have his score. I think it does a good job at setting the tone for that kind of melodrama of the film.
Yeah, it's like, you know, prestige action and adventure movies, like his music always carries that sound to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cinematography is by Richard Klein. I think this movie looks very, very good. I think the cinematography alone kind of kicks it up like a star rating, in my opinion. He'd been working for a little while, actually, maybe like a decade or so. He started in the mid-60s. He shot the movie Camelot, Hang 'em High, the Clint Eastwood movie, The Andromeda Strain. He had shot like a number of like sci-fi and action movies, so he was definitely like a big sort of mainstream Hollywood cinematographer.
The production backstory and release of this film is not complicated per se, but there the whole tangled web of rights with King Kong properties is mind-boggling. I had to reference several different websites to like try to get it straight.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of King Kong 1976, Dino De Laurentiis went to RKO in the 1970s, and RKO wasn't even like a functioning movie studio at that time, but they had the rights to the film or the title or the property, and they sold it to Dino De Laurentiis. But apparently NBC and producer Sid Sheinberg and Michael Eisner of Disney fame,
mm-hmm,
claimed that RKO had sold them the rights. So it went to the courts, and Dino De Laurentiis and Paramount ended up getting the rights to this film with the condition that NBC Universal could make their own King Kong, but had to wait at least 18 months. Well, Peter Jackson's King Kong is that Universal King Kong, much, much longer than 18 months, but they eventually made their own too. So yeah, just like a lot of legalese around all that production.
And kind of like a lot of competing claims as to who came up with the idea, right? Like De Laurentiis is like, oh, I got the idea because my daughter loves this movie. And then Michael Eisner was like, no, when I was an ABC executive, like I'm the one that came up with the idea to make it. So yeah, I mean, like who knows like who actually had the originating idea to remake this movie.
But like, I'm sure they both had an idea to make King Kong. It's not, you know, it's just like,
let's remake one of the most well-known American movies of all time. It's not a super original idea.
Right. The odds of two producers coming up with that are not, it's not far-fetched to think.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And then probably like in the wake of this movie, well, maybe I'm getting a little ahead of ourselves, but I'm guessing Universal didn't really want to make another version of this movie in the immediate aftermath of it. Hence the, you know, delay.
Yeah, the 30-year delay.
Yeah.
So in regards to the contemporary setting of King Kong, De Laurentiis and Lorenzo Semple intentionally wanted to move it away from Marion C. Cooper's 1933 in tone, in aesthetic. They wanted to set it in the 1970s. They wanted to incorporate the World Trade Center. They wanted, which was new at the time. It had only opened, I think, in 72, and was at the time the two tallest buildings in the world. So I don't blame them for doing that. Because at the time, of the 33 King Kong, the Empire State Building was the tallest in the world. So I could see a case for updating it in that regard.
And I like, you know, another new wrinkle in the story is the, like, as you talked about, the Petrox Corporation, which was inspired by like actual oil drilling in various parts of the world in the 70s. Of course, that was a big sort of controversy in the Middle East at the time. So I think that was kind of an attempt to reflect what was going on politically in the world also. And I kind of admire that update as well.
I do too, actually. I was like, oh, I like this. There's a, because how many movies do you get that incorporate the 1970s oil crisis that we all know about?
Yeah, right. After doing a little bit of research beforehand. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, I mean, like, it does, there's not like a lot of like political commentary here, but there is definitely the sense that, like, you know, the Charles Grodin character is this dastardly villainous, like, what's the word, imperialist, kind of, you know, like trying to sort of like exploit the world, which obviously he does with King Kong at the end, bringing him back to New York and whatnot. So yeah, I think there's like a shade of political commentary there.
I do too. And I was being an ass before. But I do think it, I do like the fact that it incorporates the 1970s oil crisis.
Yeah. It's weird though, because then, like, you know, Dwan sort of just like washes up in a lifeboat or like a raft or whatever. And she was like making a movie, but she just like, is it ever really explained? Like, she just like, is there like a shipwreck or something? And she just like happens upon this like oil boat.
Yes.
It's weird. Yeah.
That's all that, that's all they explain about that.
So there is still the sort of like maverick filmmaking thing, but it's never totally like believable in this case.
No, I don't mind that so much. It's just the Dwan character in general, which I'll get to.
Yeah.
So Matt, as you mentioned earlier, there are no dinosaurs in this movie. Another departure from Marion C. Cooper and Ernest Schoedstack's original film. De Laurentiis didn't want to deal with stop motion, which, as we know from our episode on King Kong, is very time consuming and very expensive.
I mean, compared to the, you know, the suitmation and like the little bit of like a, what's the word, like a mechanical King Kong in this movie, stop motion probably would have looked better for the most part.
I mean, the Kong suit work, I think, is really good, but that mechanical snake that they pull out, yeah, that could have been bettered by just about anything.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, so it's kind of too bad because this was like a big production that pulled out some of the stops, but not all the stops, because, you know, if they had spent more time and money and effort on the stop motion, that could have been pretty amazing looking.
But also, I feel like stop motion, I'm making a case against it now. I feel like the way this movie is shot, the way it takes itself, I feel like stop motion wouldn't fit with the tone of this movie.
Yeah, I could see that. I think you're right.
Yeah.
But that's kind of to the detriment in the movie a little bit, but I think you're right for sure.
Right. That's, yeah, that's like a weird catch-22 with this film, that I'm conflicted with this movie. I really am, because I think it conflicts with itself, like you said earlier.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah. So like we talked about earlier, Jessica Lange was an unknown actor when she was cast in the film. She was a model, I think, at the time, but this was her first big leading role. Jeff Bridges was a popular leading man, kind of becoming a star around this time. And maybe also becoming stars, or just about to, were the special effects designers, Carlo Rambaldi and Rick Baker. Rambaldi would go on to do the special effects for E.T. the Extraterrestrial and Alien, which I think was the same year as King Kong. Am I right about that?
It could have been a year later, 2 years later.
Around the same time, though.
Yeah.
So yeah, he was definitely becoming like the go-to special effects guy around this time. Rick Baker, of course, would go on to do An American Werewolf in London. The Howling, I think he did as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some other werewolf, non-werewolf movies that are not coming to mind right now.
Harry and the Hendersons.
Oh, of course. Yeah. One of my favorites.
Men in Black.
Yep. Did he do Death Becomes Her as well? Or am I, that was a lot of CGI, I guess. Maybe not.
Maybe. I don't remember confidently enough. But yeah, multiple Academy Award winner. His makeup effects are iconic.
Yes. So yeah, you have two special effects geniuses working together on this movie.
And did you know Rick Baker plays Kong in the suit?
I did read that, yeah. That's cool. Sort of like Tsuburaya, right? Although he never really got inside the suits, but
no, yeah. No.
I take it back then. Not like that at all. But yeah, that's pretty cool. So Rambaldi designed a 40-foot, 6.5-ton mechanical Kong that did not pan out. I think it's seen very briefly, like, I don't know, less than 30 seconds in this movie, but most of it is just the Kong suit that we see.
This is the most bonkers stat of this movie, that this giant robot gorilla was built. And of course it didn't work. You see it for the briefest of moments in the finished film, and it looks like a 40-foot statue. It doesn't look like the animatronic suit work that is featured mostly in the film.
It definitely doesn't look like an animal that like moves and sort of behaves like an animal would. It's a hunk of metal, basically. So that's unfortunate. I think there are like various like animatronic faces that we do see in the movie, like more miniature versions of like what the robot might have been like. Robot's not the right word for it. The mechanical version. And there was like a mechanical arm and hand, like a full scale version that was created for the film that's featured a little bit more prominently. But yeah, the full version is barely glimpsed.
They should have cut it completely.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, I feel like we have to talk about Jaws on like every single episode of Camp Kaiju, but it's kind of like that, right? Like the animatronic shark like didn't work at all. And that's why Spielberg had to like shoot around it and use like implication and suggestion and stuff like that. You know, King Kong does not use implication or suggestion, but like just in terms of like the malfunctioning special effects, they have that in common.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate the Jaws reference, though.
Every episode, we have to.
Okay, you heard it, folks. The film King Kong was released, and we're going to get to Jaws actually here. The film King Kong was released in December of 1976. It was being like the production team was using Jaws as the benchmark for this kind of blockbuster. And it did not meet the box office numbers of Jaws. Although it was a success in its own right, it opened number one its weekend and finished the third highest grossing film worldwide for 1976. NBC did pay for the television rights and aired it in 1978. And I gotta, listeners, fact check us on this. I read that 45 more minutes were added to the television version of this film.
I read that too, but I don't know what they possibly could have added.
Yeah. How could this movie possibly squeeze out anything else?
Like, it already seems pretty overstuffed as it is. Like, they cover all the bases. I don't know what else.
45 minutes.
Yeah. So, I mean, like you said, if anybody out there knows, please, let us know what it is.
Yeah. And I think even today, reviews are mixed to positive. Lots of people praise the Jeff Bridges' performance, Charles Grodin's performance, and the special effects. Again, that suitmation, I think, is pretty impressive. Although reviews are way, way less forgiving on just sort of like it failing to not just live up to the 33 King Kong, but to like failing to capture the same sense of spirit and imagination.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we'll talk about it more later, but it's like, aside from money, I just don't really know exactly why they made this movie. Like, you can tell if like the original movie, like, yeah, like they had this vision, this like amazing adventure fantasy story they wanted to tell. And with the Peter Jackson remake, like he had his own interpretation of the story and he really wanted to sort of, you know, take more time on. Is the character's name Anne? It is, right? In that version?
Yeah.
Like, you know, her background as an actress and then like her relationship with Kong. So you know why he wanted to make that movie too. With this, it's like, so you just wanted to remake it. Like, why? I don't know. And I think you see that in the special effects too. It's like, they just kind of were like, what can we do to like recreate the look of the original? Like, they don't really seem to have like an original and inspired take on it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Oil Crisis, though, am I right?
That is like one of my favorite aspects of the remake, but it's not much. It's like a very small part of the movie.
Yeah. The film was nominated for some Oscars, though, and did win best visual effects for Carlo Rambaldi, Glenn Robinson, and Frank Van Devere. Cinematography, Richard Klein's cinematography was nominated, along with best sound. All right, well, let's get to our sponsor break, and then we could talk about the themes, and I can read some comments in Mina's mailbox. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. Okay, I'm pulling up our Instagram, one of many places you can drop us a line. And I posted a reel of a scene from Orca, the killer whale. And we had a lot of love for that reel. So we had Richard Rock 71. He commented, "Awesome classic, still watch it today." We have another one.
Well, I love all the Orca stuff that you posted. It looks great. There are so many like strange and like over the top images and like moments from that movie. It's really fun to see that.
Yeah. We had some commenters talk about how they watched Orca on some late night killer animal, monster animal marathons in the 90s. Hmm. And I was like, that's awesome. Like, do you have any other suggestions? And they threw out Tentacles, another Dino De Laurentiis production. So whoever you are, whoever commented on that, thank you. Reach out to us again, and I'll give you due credit if you want. But we definitely have Tentacles on our radar. On our sonar, I should say.
Tentacles on our sonar. Let's get out of here. It's a dumb joke.
Heard the ship around.
Yeah. This is going to turn into an old-fashioned radio show. We should do that sometime. That'd be great. It'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you all for writing in. We appreciate hearing your love for monster movies. Matt, do you have any themes for this movie? King Kong, 1976, directed by Guillermo.
Guillermo's one and only King Kong. Well, actually not his one and only, because no. So never mind. We talked briefly about like the political commentary with like the oil company going in and exploiting this foreign land. Aside from that, like I think most of the themes were kind of repeats from the original, you know? Like we have the clash between modernity and like the indigenous community on the island, on Skull Island, which is just about as offensive here as it is in the original King Kong. Maybe even more so because they don't really make an attempt to like address that or update it at all. But, you know, like, I guess what I'm getting at is that like, it's kind of asking, you know, like, what's the real, like, what is the value of civilization if like somebody like Fred can go in and be so sort of callous and like exploitative? Like, what does civilization mean? That kind of question, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's repeated here a little bit. I think, you know, like what separates humanity from the animal kingdom, if anything, like Kong is probably more sympathetic and more human than most of the human characters in this movie.
And I'd say Kong here is more human-like than in the 33 version.
Yeah.
I feel like there's more effort to, I don't know, make Kong and, in this case, Duan's relationship a bit more human, a bit kinder, more relatable.
Yeah, and I do like that update. You know, like, and Peter Jackson again goes even further with that, and like Naomi Watts gives a really, really very good performance in that version of it. But yeah, I think it's very well done here as well. And I think like the expressions that we see on Kong's face, yeah, certainly they're more human. There's like more of an element of humor, of vulnerability, of love. So yeah, that part of it is well done, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But I agree with you. I mean, the themes, other than the oil crisis, there isn't much added to what we've already covered in the 1933 version, which I think hampers the film. I think it hampers the film's staying power. Yeah. Until that next oil crisis hits, then we'll all be like, Guillermin's Kong was the bell ringer for our modern times.
It foresaw the future. It's only a matter of time.
I do think that the sort of the rape of the natural environment of the land, I'm using that word as, you know, metaphor, is more so in this movie. The natives on Skull Island completely disappear. Like, they're almost obligatory, but then after like their dance and everything, they're gone.
Yeah.
And all the oil people, they just make themselves right at home. They set up camp on the beach. The Charles Grodin's just sipping pina coladas or whatever. There's heavy machinery that's moved in. It focuses on that aspect a bit more.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, but it doesn't like go into too much detail about like it's kind of just like, what am I trying to say? I'm sorry. Like the oil company is like clearly the bad guy, and there's like not really any like complexity or like detail to it. Like it's not like it really goes into too much depth beyond that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which is too bad. And then like the Jeff Bridges character, he's like a primate paleontologist, I think. And he is introduced into the story because he just like climbs aboard the ship before it disembarks, which is kind of like unbelievable. But anyway, like, you know, I was kind of hoping that maybe there would be more of a theme of like evolution and kind of like I referred to like the difference between like man and animals. But the movie doesn't really go into that all that much. It's kind of just there, but it's not really like elaborated on, you know? And right. I would say that's true of most of the themes in this movie.
And I would say, well, it's just a King Kong movie, but it's not the King Kong movie. So it tries to eat it, have its cake and eat it too.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, again, conflicted with the, what this movie wants to be.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. How about form and aesthetic?
Yeah, conflicted is right. I think like the cinematography is good in some ways. It's very bright and colorful. It's well lit. Although if it's calling a movie well lit is maybe like the lamest compliment you can possibly give it. But I think like one of the ways that this movie really fails is in its composite photography, where like, you know, there's like some special effects in the foreground, and then maybe there's like a middle ground that's like a matte painting, and then there's a background that's maybe a different matte painting, or like, you know, like it's a combination of like various planes of action that's all kind of smushed together. And I actually think that it looks better in the original 1933 King Kong than it does here. And I think a big part of the reason why is that the original was black and white, and here this is in color, and you can very clearly see like the kind of like fuzzy edges of like what was like shot in a studio and what's like a matte painting behind it and stuff like that. But in any case, it's never very convincing. And I think sometimes it looks really horrible. Like the scene where Kong carries Duan to the waterfall after she falls in a mud pit. And then like he kind of like blows on her to dry her off. It's sort of a sweet moment, but I don't think it looks very good. And like the combination of different footage that was shot at different times or at least created in different ways is never very convincing in this movie.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Those moments do stick out like sore thumbs.
Mm-hmm.
I see, the first time I watched this movie 2 years ago, I was very unforgiving. I didn't like really anything about it, except the oil crisis. But this time and it's so funny because it's like after watching Orca, which is so, I think there's a lot of similarities between the way Orca is shot and King Kong, actually, at least with like terms of like ships at sea and sunsets. And I was like, oh, and I get where De Laurentiis is coming from now. So yeah, in a weird way, Orca upped my appreciation for King Kong.
Cool.
But in terms of like cinematography or lighting, I really like the use of, like, there's a lot of night scenes where the black is really pitch black.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of use of smoke. And like, there's this scene where they capture Kong with the chloroform. and Kong's hand rises out of the chloroform. It's all very ghostly and atmospheric. So I think there's like a lot of great use of truly of lighting.
Yeah, I agree. That scene where they capture Kong is probably my favorite scene in the movie, and it looks really fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in general, I like the first half of this movie more than the second half.
Yeah,
I think like the scene where, you know, Duan is tied up and is kind of being offered to Kong, and then she like looks up and sees this huge beast. Like, it doesn't have the same kind of like magic that the original did, but it looks really good. And it's a convincing sort of like fantasy environment, you know? And then I think it gets less convincing after that point.
I agree with you. I think I wrote this in my notes that when they leave Skull Island, it became less interesting. It became, mm-hmm. I don't know, like, okay, can we just like wrap this up? I feel like we're just treading water at this point. Like when Duan and Jack go into a bar just to like, why? Just to have a drink and like be cute together. We're just padding the runtime. Like, why is this here?
Yeah, totally. And then like they end up in the train that Kong, you know, demolishes basically. Whereas in the original King Kong, like there's a similar scene, but like the heroes are not on that train. And I think like bringing them onto that train in sort of like a laborious or belabored way, like you were talking about. Yeah, we don't really need that. Like, we kind of just like need the destruction. It doesn't necessarily need to be those two characters that are in danger.
Right. Actually, to defend this, I love that train sequence. I think that that's a great action set piece with great effects. But again, we know how this movie's going to end. Let's just get to it. What do you think about the bloodbath that was Kong's demise in this movie?
It's effective, you know, in kind of like a cheap way. Like, I think, you know, like shooting a helpless animal and like having all this blood splatter is like a pretty cheap way to like engender sympathy for the Kong character. But it does work in like a very crass kind of way, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I don't know if I love it or even like it, but it's so 70s to me. Like, let's get blood on the screen and just like, it's like very Bonnie and Clyde. We're just going to riddle our character with bullets in a very like 70s way.
Yeah, certainly. I don't know. It's probably unfair to compare it to the original, which is such a great movie. But like, you know, I mean, we're affected by just who Kong is in the original movie, like his plight, the fact that he's powerless in this like gleaming metropolis of New York City. Like, that's what makes the original work. And here it's kind of just like, you know, squibs, like blood effects. It's like not the same kind of effect, you know?
Oh my god, this is in my bad category. Oh, we can just get there and I'll try to remember it. So I'm ready to move on if you are.
Well, I'll just say, like, I do think like the beginning looks really good, like the scenes of like the ship leaving port and like all the like non-special effect stuff looks pretty good in this movie.
I agree.
Yeah, so the good. It is fun to see Jeff Bridges and Jessica Lange in early roles. I don't think their characters are especially deep, but they have a lot of charisma. I think they have good chemistry together. You know, it's just a good story. It doesn't really add that much from the original version, but there are still scenes that are very powerful. Like the scene where like the men are like trying to like cross the tree that's like straddling like a valley or whatever. And like Kong is like trying to shake them off. Is still a very exciting scene. So, you know, I mean, I wish it like kind of took a more radical approach to what the original King Kong did so well, but it at least recreates it pretty faithfully and pretty effectively a lot of the time.
Right. Yep. I like that they kept that scene. I liked that. I really appreciated the Charles Grodin character this time around. I met him on his own terms as a campy, you know, mustache twirling villain. And I was like, okay, I understand where you're going now.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. I was going to save him for my campy category, but that's, he's so over the top with like his, you know, like his pith helmet and like his sort of like safari gear or whatever. It really seems like a very like over the top flamboyant parody of like somebody who thinks that he's an explorer. And it's very, very funny.
Yeah. Yeah. I've covered a lot of what I loved already. I love the suitmation, actually. And I love some of the use of set. Like you could like this was shot on not only on location but also in a studio, and I like the way that those sets are constructed with the mountains and the black drop, the psych or whatever behind them. Yeah, I think there's some effective staging in this movie.
Yeah. You know, we did already bring up the moment where they capture Kong, but like the big kind of wall set in that scene. It's great in the original too, but like here it's really well done. It looks fantastic. I don't hate the World Trade Center ending. There's the fun moment where like Kong leaps from one tower to the other. And like that moment itself, I was like, okay, I'm glad that you like changed the setting at the end here. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I don't hate it either.
So I kind of like that.
Yeah.
Should I talk about the bad stuff?
Oh, yes, please.
Oh, sorry. I didn't. Did you have more good stuff that you wanted to bring up?
I had no other good things to say about this movie.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like the suitmation itself isn't bad, but I mentioned before, I think like the composite photography looks pretty sloppy. I think special effects in general were at like a weird in between in the 70s where like, before that, you had like good Ray Harryhausen like stop motion animation, and then after that, like starting in the 90s, you had some good CGI, some terrible CGI, but also some good stuff. So here, it's just like, what do we do with special effects? Like, I know Rambaldi and Baker are like, you know, very good and very innovative, but it just like in comparison doesn't look all that great here.
Yeah, a move to mechanical machines and devices. Which they did better than anybody, but sometimes you can miss, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. But I think for me, the thing that I dislike the most about this movie, and I kind of mentioned this before, but I just don't know why they made it, except for like the desire to make money. Like they didn't add anything significantly to the story, except for the oil crisis. but yeah, I mean, aside from that, like, you know, like they did deepen the relationship between Juan and Kong a little bit. But like, yeah, this to me seems like a pretty blatant cash grab. And, you know, that's always a very unfortunate motivation to make a movie.
I'm not on board with like, yes, Kong and Juan's relationship is deeper, but I would argue it's even creepier and perverted than ever before. Rick Baker's eyes behind that mask, like when they light up, I'm like, okay, chill, dude. You're 40 feet tall, okay?
Yeah. I don't want to imagine anything more about what's going to happen here, yeah.
Well, like the waterfall scene, I just feel like the team is pushing the boundaries of like, how intimate are these characters going to get?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess depending on your taste, you're either like, oh, it's fine, it's a cute love story, or you're like, this is kind of weird, I don't know where this is going.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I, you know, so many perhaps unfair comparisons here, but like the Peter Jackson version, their relationship is like, is loving and like pretty like platonic, you know, like they're, mm-hmm. they become quick friends or whatever, Kong and Andu. But here, yeah, like I think maybe because Jessica Lange is so sexualized, it does take on a more perverse element in this movie.
Yeah, yeah. Also, just Skull Island. I know this movie, the take on this movie is more of like a drama, romance film, what have you. I'm just really missing the sense of danger on Skull Island. The snake doesn't cut it for me. King Kong is fine, but I think King Kong is also defined by his other animal rivals. You know, if it's a T-Rex or what, but that snake, if that's the best you got, it's kind of lame. Skull Island.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. And it seems like the Skull Island scenes in general in this movie are like less than or about equal to like the lead up and like what happens afterwards back in New York City. Whereas in the original, like, you know, like we're there for like what's on the island. That's the most exciting part of the movie. So yeah, it's unfortunate that this movie doesn't really offer us that.
Yeah, that's where I'll leave my bad stuff. How about campy stuff?
The one and only Charles Grodin. C. Grode, I call him. Yeah, I love him in this movie. I feel like he knows what he wants to do with this movie. He's trying to make like a campy, over the top, funny, performance, parody, like I said before. And like, I feel like if other people were like trying to do the same thing that he was doing, maybe I would like this a lot more. But yeah, he's great. You know, the Jeff Bridges character is kind of campy in a way, just because he's like running around shirtless, and he's like clearly supposed to be sort of like the sexy ape man himself a little bit. So I guess that's kind of funny and campy, but not in the same way that Charles Grodin is.
How about when Dwan referenced Deep Throat in this movie?
Yeah, that's a little too on the nose, I think. Maybe that's a bad expression to use there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, this is not good. Don't do this. It immediately dates your film,
Yeah.
even then, right? Like, we get it.
Yeah, exactly. I think there are some other references like that too that are not really coming to mind right now, but some like very 70s things that just like are dated immediately.
When King Kong is on the top of the World Trade Center and the helicopters are flying around him, I'm gonna say green screen is used, and it is just like a wild whirlwind of helicopters swirling around Kong. But like, the helicopters are at times as big as Kong himself.
Yeah.
Like, there's no respect for ratio with the use of green screen in that sequence.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of what I mean by like the sloppy composite cinematography. Like they never really do a very good job of like matching perspective or size or anything like that. So it's a little sloppy. And sometimes that can look kind of just like cool and weird and surreal, and I don't mind it sometimes, but here it's like you're like, this is a huge Hollywood production. You're supposed to like put more care into this, you know?
All right. Well, if you don't have anything else, I think we can get down to our breakdown, our final rating.
So, as usual, our ratings on Camp Kaiju are: number one, it's a timeless classic and definitely stands the test of time. Number two, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and stands the test of time. Number three, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And our lowest ranking, it is not worth revisiting and definitely does not stand the test of time.
I'm interested. Where are you at with this movie?
I'm going to give it our second lowest ranking. I think it is fun at times. I think sometimes it looks good. But yeah, it does not stand the test of time. I absolutely will return to the original King Kong. I've done so already numerous times. And I could see myself rewatching the Peter Jackson one as well. But here it's like you see it once and you kind of know what it is. I don't feel the need to revisit it again.
Actually, I agree. I think there are some fun moments. I don't think it's historically significant. I think it's just a remake of a classic movie that, for better or for worse, pales in comparison to the original. And once you've seen it, it's for me, it was hard to get back into it. But I know this movie is loved by a lot of people. And I could see why. I think just for me here now, after seeing so many other versions of Kong, this one kind of falls to the bottom of the pile.
I agree. For people that love other versions of King Kong, I think they should see this just to like be a completist and like compare it and all that. But yeah, it's the worst one that I've seen.
Until King Kong Lives.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Maybe that'll be better. It's possible.
Only one way to find out.
Yeah, exactly. I forgot one of my favorite campy things, which is just the name Dwan itself. I think it's hilarious that like it's not Anne and it's not Dawn, it's Dwan. I love that. I wanted to make sure that I said that at some point.
Oh, Dwan.
We hardly knew
Yeah.
you.
This was fun. I'm glad we got to talk about another King Kong.
Yeah, me too. I mean, like you've said on a past episode, now we'll have to watch the Kong Skull Island movies to be true completists.
Yeah, I
But you've
think
already seen them. I have not, though.
there are maybe s at least six other Kong films out there. The Son of Kong, Godzilla versus Kong, King Kong Lives, King Kong versus Godzilla, and the forthcoming Godzilla and Kong. So that's five.
I forgot about all the kind of Toho crossovers. Yeah, I would love to see those too.
Yeah.
I'm sure they will make an appearance at some point on Camp Kaiju.
Well, we got our work cut out for us.
We do. We do indeed. There is no shortage of monster movies in our future.
All right. Well, we'll see you next time, everybody. Thank you for hanging out. If you liked what you heard, please tell a friend, leave a rating and review wherever you listen, and visit CampKaijuMovieReviews.com or Instagram for more monster movie content. We can't thank you enough. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with theme music by Terrence Jackson and Mina's Mailbox by Ben Cook Feltz. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio.
Were you goddamn showing us pig apes? What are you waiting for? You want to eat me? Then go ahead! Do it! Go ahead and eat me! Go ahead! Choke on me! Oh, I didn't mean that. Honest, I didn't. Sometimes I get too physical. It's a sign of insecurity, you know? Like when you knock down trees. Such a nice ape. Such a nice, sweet, nice, sweet, sweet monkey. You know, we're gonna be great friends.